Well, thank you. Along with what many other speakers have said, I want to thank the organizers for putting together what I found to be a very interesting week. So, I'd like to tell you, as my title says, both some old things and some new things about large N gauge theories. The new portions will involve some work I've done in collaboration with two, well, recently ex-students, Pavel Kovtun and Mitat Insel, and involves work that's in a paper that was just put out and a forthcoming paper that'll be out soon. So I thought I'd have to apologize for talking about old material, but hearing about what Navier did back in the 19th century sort of sets a standard. So I'm only going to go 25 or so years back and review a little bit about what's known about the general structure of large N limits. Several speakers have already referred to the fact that in the large N limit, 1 over N plays the role analogous to H bar in semi-classical limits. And it's a natural question to say, how can you really make that precise? And one can truly make that precise. You can show that in many theories, large N gauge theories, variety of spin models, vector models, that the large N limit really is a particular form of classical limit. And to really make that explicit, you should ask to see a real formulation of classical dynamics that reproduces the large N limit of the underlying quantum dynamics of the theory you started with. So some classical phase space, some classical Hamiltonian, all the usual structure of classical dynamics. And the nicest way I know to really do that really just mimics or generalizes what you can do in point particle quantum mechanics. Namely, think about some large N gauge theory in the language of a Hamiltonian formulation. So it's quantum mechanics, it's states, it's a Hilbert space. And define what are really generalizations of coherent states that in this case will be gauge invariant coherent states in a non-abelian gauge theory. And the nicest way of thinking about how you should define such coherent states is to recall that ordinary Gaussian coherent states in point particle quantum mechanics, there's many, many ways of saying how you can formulate Gaussian coherent states, but one way is to say all you do is you pick some initial state and you act on it with some group of unitary operators that are simply translations in position and momentum. In other words, you look at the group which is generated by coordinate operators and their conjugate momenta. And it turns out, say in a pure Yang-Mills theory, exactly that same idea works. If you consider a Lie algebra that contains arbitrary linear combinations of Wilson loops, you should think of those as coordinates. And Wilson loops with one electric field insertion, you should think of that as their conjugate momenta. Such operators have commutators that close to form a Lie algebra. It's a big Lie algebra. You could exponentiate it and form a big group of unitary operators, and you can take those operators, apply it to some convenient initial state, and that defines coherent states for large N Yang-Mills theory. And just so I can give it a name, I'll call this group of unitary operators that generates coherent states, I'll call it a coherence group. And what you can show are some key properties. Technically, you show that this group acts irreducibly on the gauge invariant Hilbert space of the theory. That's simply a fancy way of showing that these coherent states are overcomplete, that any gauge invariant state could be represented as a linear combination of them. You can show that if some operator has vanishing diagonal coherent state expectation values for all coherent states, then the operator vanishes. In other words, that says that any quantum operator is completely defined just by its diagonal coherent state matrix elements. You don't need off-diagonal matrix elements at all. This also mimics what's true of ordinary Gaussian coherent states in point particle quantum mechanics. And then most importantly, you look at the overlap of two different coherent states, and you discover that it vanishes exponentially as n becomes large. And this, of course, ultimately just reflects the fact that we have order n squared degrees of freedom, and at overlap, you get a suppression from every one of them. Okay, well, you can show those statements, and the nice thing is that's all you have to do to demonstrate that you really have a classical limit. The appropriate classical phase space is, in essence, equivalent to just the space of coherent states. If you want to make that sound fancier, you say the classical phase space is a coadjoint orbit of the coherence group. The classical action that's going to generate classical dynamics that reproduces the large n limit of quantum dynamics in a Hamiltonian form of the action, all you do is you take a time derivative minus the quantum Hamiltonian, take its coherent state expectation value, rescale it, and take the large n limit. The result defines a functional on your classical phase space that is the classical action. And coherent state expectation values of quantum operators in the large n limit give you functions on phase space, and that is the mapping of quantum operators into classical observables. Products of operators factorized, that's the usual large n factorization. And most importantly, coherent state expectations of quantum commutators, rescaled by n squared, have a finite limit, which is the natural Poisson bracket on the phase space. And the symplectic structure that defines that Poisson bracket is completely determined by the group structure of the coherence group. So there's no new information that you need to define it. So, well, these statements are exactly what you need to show that the quantum equations of motion really turn into the classical Hamilton equations, so that's what you need to really show that you do have quantum dynamics that's reproducing, classical dynamics that's reproducing quantum dynamics. So, given that classical dynamics, if you ask what's it's good for, I want to emphasize that it encodes an awful lot of information. I think it's very misleading to say that the large n limit of QCD is a free theory, in the sense that this leading large n classical dynamics contains within it all the information to determine expectation values of Wilson loops, sure, no big deal, also things like glueball and meson masses, but the same leading classical dynamics also has all the information you need to find the leading large n behavior of decay amplitudes, scattering amplitudes, or connected correlators, even though they all vanish as n goes to infinity. Namely, this is the information to determine the non-trivial limits when you suitably rescale them by factors of n. And all this is really saying, it's the same thing as saying in a usual weakly coupled theory, knowing the form of the classical action is all you need to calculate anything that involves tree graphs. And scattering amplitudes vanish like some positive power of h-bar if you put h-bars back into them, but to compute them, all you need is the classical action. Okay, so this is a sort of pretty elegant formal structure. You're free to say, what's it good for? What can you really do with it? And there are sort of two styles of answer I want to comment on. There's the direct frontal assault. You could say, given this formulation of the large n limit, okay, you want to go solve the theory. Well, that reduces to one very simple problem. You have some classical Hamiltonian defined as a limit of a coherent state expectation. It's some function on phase space. solving a theory just means find the point on phase space that minimizes a Hamiltonian. Piece of cake. You can really do that in all the examples of theories where you know how to solve the large n limit explicitly. In non-abelian gauge theories, the problem is you got this infinite dimensional phase space. This is a hideously complicated function to write down explicitly, and actually carrying out that minimization is really, really hard. Nevertheless, asking how are we going to find the QCD string? Well, there it is. It's in there. Or in a sense, finding the QCD string is just asking, what are convenient coordinates to lay down on this n equals infinity phase space that will make some more explicit expression for this possible? But that's a practical question, a matter of choosing coordinates for classical dynamics. Okay, well, I wish I had now piles of results to show you from actually just rolling up my sleeves, finding a good numerical approximation for carrying out this minimization. I happen to believe it's possible. I worked on it quite a bit about 20 years ago. I still believe it's possible. I even suspect that it will produce actual results for quantities in large N QCD, which you can't find by just using symmetries, quicker than finding an elegant string theory formulation. But that's speculation. What I want to talk about today is something a little different. Namely, even if I can't carry out this minimization explicitly, if I have two different theories where everything I just said applies, you can do something simple. You can compare two different classical dynamical systems. You can say, are their phase spaces equivalent? Are their symplectic structures equivalent? Are their classical Hamiltonians equivalent? And if you can show that those things are equivalent, then you know you really have the same dynamics, even if solving the dynamics is hard. In other words, this provides a framework that allows you to compare the large n limits of different theories without actually having to solve either theory. And, well, as I said here, that means it's a framework where you could actually have a chance of demonstrating an exact duality in the large n limits between two different theories. That wouldn't be a conjecture, it wouldn't be something where you just test it here and there, but you'd actually have a demonstration. And that certainly piqued my interest. And I want to tell you about one application of that. All right, so everything so far is basically results that are at least 20 years old. Now I want to switch to somewhat newer, but still not particularly new, context, where I want to apply that framework I just talked about. So in a field theory context, that's what I'm going to be really talking about today, what's known colloquially as orbifold projections is a buzzword for a technique which simply says, pick some theory you want to start with, call it the parent theory, pick some discrete subgroup of the symmetry group of that theory, and now simply throw out all degrees of freedom of the theory you started with which are not invariant under your chosen discrete subgroup. The result is a different theory. Call it the daughter theory. And lots of people, a few of which are listed here, have examined various aspects of this sort of orbifold projection. As many of you know, some of you better than I do, this had its genesis in looking at string theories on orbifolds, geometric orbifolds, and looking at their low energy limits, which then involved this sort of field theory orbifold projection. That string theory context, I'm not going to say anything about. This might, however, be a useful and appropriate moment to actually thank Misha Schiffman, though, for getting me interested in this subject a few years ago. All Okay, as an example of an orbifold projection, and an example I'm going to come back to later, a nice simple example to talk about is simply n equals 1 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, which is just a theory of a gauge field plus an adjoint representation massless Weyl fermion. Consider that as the parent theory, and let me pick a simple Z2 global symmetry, which is going to define the projection, and all that will be is a combination of a global gauge transformation times minus 1 to the F, or in other words, times just flipping the sign of the fermion. So you're supposed to look at the original degrees of freedom and toss out those that are not invariant under this combined symmetry. And the result is simple. For the gauge field, what this projection does is take the gauge field that you could regard as a 2n by 2n matrix and simply reduce it to block diagonal form. So it has two independent blocks, each of which are n by n. And therefore, what you're doing is you're reducing your single U2n gauge field down to two independent UN gauge fields. For the fermions, it would have been exactly the same, except I stuck in this extra minus sign for the fermions. That has the net effect of reducing the fermions to a block off diagonal form. And that means the daughter theory is now a gauge theory with a product gauge group, and it has two bifundamental fermions. That is, fermions which are transform into fundamental representation of one UN factor and the anti-fundamental representation of the other. And this happens to be a nice example which, by construction, has a parent which is supersymmetric and has a daughter which is not at all supersymmetric. So if there is some nice relation between the large N limits of these two theories, what it's doing is relating information that you might be able to understand in a supersymmetric theory and transferring that information to a non-supersymmetric theory about which we normally have less control. And there's lots of generalizations of this sort of projection with bigger discrete symmetry groups where you have a daughter theory that has a product gauge group structure with lots and lots of factors. I won't worry about that at the moment. Okay, if you ask how are the parent and daughter theories of that specific example or of generalizations related, one thing you can do that's pretty straightforward that was discussed by Bershadsky and Johansson is just look at perturbation theory. And it's very easy to see that planar diagrams of the parent and planar diagrams of the daughter exactly coincide, provided you just make the Tuft couplings of the two theories equal. So that tells you that since planar diagrams are all that survive in the large N limit, that tells you that the perturbative expansion of the large N limit of the parent theory coincides with the perturbative expansion of the large N limit of the daughter theory. But you all know that perturbation theory only generates an asymptotic expansion. Coinciding asymptotic expansions isn't really telling you that the two sides are equal. It does, however, certainly motivate a conjecture. Maybe they really are. And that's something which a number of people got interested in, wrote papers about. In particular, Matt Strassler wrote a short paper emphasizing that if, what he termed the non-perturbative orbifold conjecture is true, namely, if this is really a duality between these two large N theories, it would relate a whole variety of information between the two theories, and it would provide a nice tool for gaining non-perturbative information about non-supersymmetric theories by connecting them with supersymmetric theories. And just as an example, an often cited example, if this conjecture is true, then there are lots of examples where, for example, you have a supersymmetric parent theory with unbroken supersymmetry, which means it has exact degeneracies between bosons and fermions in its mass spectrum. And if this conjecture is true, well, then it's saying some non-supersymmetric daughter theory in the large N limit may have also exact degeneracies between bosons and fermions, and that would be pretty remarkable in a non-supersymmetric theory. Okay. A variety of people looked at a variety of specific examples in an effort to say, is this conjecture of honest-to-God equivalence in the large N limit true or not? And the simple way of summarizing the results is to say it's confused. There are examples that were looked at where both parent and daughter were conformal. There are examples where both parent and daughter were supersymmetric. Various things looked consistent, but a number of examples where daughters were non-supersymmetric, several people looked at quantities and appeared to find a failure of this orbifold equivalence conjecture. And I'll talk a little bit about some of those failures later. Okay, so now I finally get to something that's newer. I want to do just what I said earlier of take this formalism of a coherent state construction of large N classical dynamics and see if it can be used to actually understand the validity of this large N non-perturbative orbifold conjecture. Is it true? Is it ever true? Under what conditions might it be true? What can we say? Okay, so I'll talk about a class of cases where I consider projections based on some product of cyclic groups, starting with apparent theory, which is just some gauge theory with a simple unitary gauge group. I do, however, want the theories I'm talking about to be well-defined. I actually like to know that my theories exist, and therefore I really want to think about lattice regularized theories. And so, in essence, the goal here is to understand, can there be exact large-N dualities which are exact even in the regularized theory? If they're exact in the presence of regularization, well, they certainly remain exact if you were to then take a continuum limit. All right, so I'll look at simple UN gauge theories with whatever number of adjoint fermions you want, whatever number of adjoint scalar fields you want, that doesn't matter. Choose some embedding of this discrete group, and if you do it right, you'll end up with daughter theories which have gauge groups that are just products of UN, namely UN to a power, which is just the dimension of the discrete group used to define the projection. And depending on how you choose the embedding, you'll end up with either matter fields in the adjoint or bifundamental representations. And the one detail of that daughter theory that I need is it has this product gauge group structure, and a necessary consequence of this sort of projection is that in the daughter theory there are discrete symmetries which just permute in various ways these different factors of the product gauge group, and in fact there is a ZK1 up to ZKD discrete group which is a global symmetry of the daughter theory that's just permuting those different gauge group factors. All right, and one bit of terminology, I'm going to talk about operators or states that are invariant under the symmetry used to define the projection in the parent theory, and I'll call those neutral operators or neutral states. In other words, that will be the neutral sector of the parent theory, the sector invariant under the symmetry that's being used to define the projection. And correspondingly, in the daughter theory, I'm going to be interested in operators or states that are invariant under this symmetry, this global symmetry that permutes different gauge group factors, and that I will term the neutral sector in the daughter theory. Okay, so you can go through and try and generalize exactly what I told you about the large N limits of pure Yang-Mills theory to these class of theories that differ just by having adjoint or bifundamental representation matter fields. So you have to suitably generalize what the appropriate coherence group that generalizes, that generates coherent states are. And I'll just tell you that you can argue that the appropriate generalization is to consider a big Lie algebra, which is generated by Wilson loops, which now contain decorations. You can insert in those Wilson loops any number of your matter fields, scalar or fermions, anywhere around the loop, any number of them. In addition, if you have scalars, then you need loops that have any number of scalar insertions and one scalar conjugate momentum insertion. And just as in pure Yang-Mills theory, you need ordinary Wilson loops with one electric field insertion. Those operators have commutators that close to form a Lie algebra, generates a nice coherence group, generates a big set of coherent states. All right, you'd like to compare the structure of the resulting coherence algebras in the parent and daughter theory, see whether they're related. You want to understand how observables in the two theories are related, and I'll just tell you the answer. There is a one-to-one mapping, not between all observables in the parent and all observables in the daughter, but precisely what I term neutral observables, neutral single trace observables in either the parent or daughter. This, I should emphasize, is not new. This is just my way of expressing this is the class of operators where there's a nice one-to-one mapping. Other people have termed this, that what I'm calling the neutral sector, other people have called the untwisted sector. Right. What is new and is critical is that this is not just a mapping between observables, it really is a mapping between these Lie algebras of the groups which generate coherent states, and that mapping really is an isomorphism of the algebras. To be specific, if you normalize elements of Lie algebra in such a way that the structure constants are independent of the number of colors, then the correct mapping between elements of the Lie algebra in the parent and elements of the Lie algebra in the daughter is just what I wrote here. And there's, you'll notice a difference of a factor of n. I wrote it this way because the natural normalization of generators in, say, the parent is such that expectation values of that generator are order nc squared. So dividing, what I did here is I just divided by the number of colors squared. So this is really an observable whose expectations have nice large n limits. Okay, so the point is there is a nice isomorphism between this particular neutral subalgebras of the coherence algebra. Instantly means there's a nice isomorphism between the neutral subgroups of the coherence groups. That instantly means there's a natural isomorphism between the coadjoint orbits of the subgroups of the coherence algebras of the coherence groups that are neutral. To say that a little less formally, it means there really is a perfect isomorphism between the neutral subspaces of the n equals infinity classical phase spaces of these parent and daughter theories. All right, in other words, the symplectic structure is restricted to that subspace of the phase space, completely coincides. And it means the classical dynamics within those sectors will completely coincide as long as you have corresponding classical Hamiltonians. What that requires is that the parent Hamiltonian and the daughter Hamiltonian be related just the way I wrote here. In other words, you have to scale it correctly in a way that involves a factor of m, which was the order of the discrete group that defined my projection. Okay, so there is this isomorphism between a sector of the large N classical dynamics of the parent theory and a sector of the large N classical dynamics of the daughter theory. whether that's interesting or not, whether it teaches you anything that's going to have value for physics, depends on one simple thing. Is the ground state of the theory, is the vacuum state that you're going to be interested in, does it lie within this neutral sector or not? That's just a question of, is the symmetry that you use to define this projection spontaneously broken in the parent theory, or is it unbroken? And along with that, is this discrete symmetry permuting gauge group factors spontaneously broken in the daughter theory, or is it unbroken in the daughter theory? If both of these symmetries are unbroken, then the vacuum states of both theories lie in this neutral sector, and then this equivalence between neutral sectors is really telling us that there's an exact relation in the large N limit between all kinds of physical quantities between these parent and daughter theories. In other words, these symmetry realization conditions are both necessary and sufficient conditions for large N orbifold equivalence. Necessity is no surprise. I mean, if these symmetries are broken, it's clear this orbifold, non-perturbative orbifold conjecture fails. What's new is to actually have a way of showing that these are sufficient. There's no other way that the non-perturbative orbifold conjecture can fail except by having one of these two symmetry realizations, or both, fail. Okay, let me talk about this in a little more detail in the context of that very first example that I talked about, the N equals 1 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory and its Z2 projection. So I'll switch back to continuum notation. I'll consider both theories with a theta parameter. And so, well, the parent theory is just the usual F squared and FF dual term, Weyl fermions, and I've added a soft supersymmetry breaking mass term just so I can use it as an interesting deformation. And this theory has a non-anomalous chiral symmetry that's discrete, Z4n, and we really know that that discrete chiral symmetry breaks down to a Z2 due to a Gluino condensate. And if you turn on a small mass, you can trivially calculate the shift in the vacuum energy to first order in the soft mass, and it's proportional to the Gluino condensate with a phase, which of course depends on the theta parameter that you choose in the parent theory. The fact that it's theta over 2n is precisely reflecting the fact that we broke a Z4n down to a Z2 symmetry, so there's 2n different equivalent ground states. Okay, that's the supersymmetric parent theory. The daughter differs only a little bit. We have two different field strength squares. We have two different FF dual terms. There's a sum that's J over 1 and 2 over these two different gauge group factors. We have these bifundamental fermions. The only gauge invariant small mass term we can add now involves the, not so to speak, the square of a fermion, but involves the product of the two different Weyl fermions in the daughter theory, because that's the only way to make something that's gauge invariant. You can essentially repeat the whole discussion. This theory now has a Z2n non-anomalous chiral symmetry. One can argue, certainly convincingly on physical grounds, that there will be a fermion bilinear condensate here, which will break that chiral symmetry down to an unbroken Z2. You can again say that the first order shift in the vacuum energy is proportional to the fermion condensate times a phase. And the form of this phase is again reflecting the fact that there are now n different equivalent ground states. All right, there's nothing new there. So everything I just showed there, you can find in multiple places. You can, in particular, find it in some papers that Misha and collaborators wrote. And you can look at those formulas and easily see that if the gauge couplings are arranged in such a way that the Itauf couplings are equal, if the fermion condensates are arranged in such a way that the vacuum energies coincide, well, if the vacuum energies coincide, the topological susceptibilities don't. I mean, in essence, that's just a consequence of seeing the different theta dependence in the parent and daughter theories. And this was argued to be death for the non-perturbative orbifold conjecture, and was suggested to really be a generic problem. And I certainly found this puzzling. However, you have to be sure that you've really translated information from the parent to the daughter correctly. And the mapping that I showed you in that formal way a moment ago really tells you how the Hamiltonian or the action of the parent theory has to be related to the Hamiltonian or parent of the daughter theory if there is to be a large N equivalence. And that mapping, well, for the most part, does just what you expect. It tells you, for example, that trace of F squared in the parent maps into trace of the sum of the field strength squared in the daughter. It tells you that trace of the Guino condensate in the parent maps to, well, the appropriate fermion condensate in the daughter. However, the correct statement of the equivalence was not that you take the Lagrangian or Hamiltonian of the parent, throw out degrees of freedom that are not invariant under the projection, and declare the result the Hamiltonian or Lagrangian of the daughter. There was a factor of M in the correct relation. There was an overall scaling of the Hamiltonian of the daughter relative to that of the parent. For this example of a Z2 projection, that's just a factor of 2. And it's not a big deal, but it's important to know that it's there. So if you look at the different terms in the Lagrangian, this factor of 2 is exactly what you need so that you have equality of Itauf couplings. And of course, that's been well known. That you see directly in perturbation theory. But it's also responsible for telling you that the theta angle in the parent should not be identified with the theta angle in the daughter. There's a factor of 2 there as well. If you think about supersymmetric theories and holomorphic couplings, that's of course no surprise. These two things have to fit together. All right? But the same factor of 2 tells you that if you now take vacuum expectation values, you don't want the total vacuum energy of the parent to coincide with the total vacuum energy of the daughter. There's a factor of 2 there as well. One easy way to think about that I find easy to explain is don't actually think about the vacuum energy. Think about the free energy at non-zero temperature. Think about asymptotically large temperature, where the free energy basically just counts the number of degrees of freedom. This factor of 2 in that case is simply saying that the high temperature free energy of the parent theory is twice the high temperature free energy of the daughter theory, and that makes perfect sense because we threw out half the degrees of freedom in going from the parent to the daughter. Okay, the bottom line is, if you now go back to the formulas I just showed you for vacuum energies in the presence of a small mass, if you infer from those formulas topological susceptibilities, you will see that there is absolutely no inconsistency there at all. That those formulas are precisely what they have to be for validity of the large N orbifold equivalence in this example of parent and daughter theories. So proving symmetry realizations is always hard. You know, proving whether some theory spontaneously breaks a symmetry or not typically involves hard non-perturbative dynamics. There's nothing here that's a magic bullet that gives you a new technique for proving whether some symmetry is broken or not in some theory. But certainly everything we know about these two theories I've just talked about is consistent with satisfying the symmetry realization conditions needed for the orbifold equivalence conjecture. Or more carefully, that's true when these theories are formulated on R4, infinite volume. You're of course free to consider the same theories formulated on, say, compactified manifolds, which several people have done. And for example, you can compare a number of instanton zero modes in the parent and daughter theories and you discover they don't match. And that really is a sign of some problem when your treatment of instantons is reliable. And it's reliable for sufficiently small radius. These are both asymptotically free theories, so for small radius, the effective coupling you can keep small and have control over. So that really is evidence that the orbifold equivalence fails when these theories are compactified on sufficiently small radius, but there's only one way it can fail, and that's to change a symmetry realization. And that was shown very nicely and explicitly in a little paper by David Tong. The Z2 symmetry in the daughters breaks spontaneously when this theory is compactified on sufficiently small radius. All right, so that's certainly consistent with the general results. Okay, this is just one example illustrating how this large N non-perturbative equivalence plays out. You can certainly look at lots of other examples. Here are just some examples that I think are kind of fun or interesting. First of all, if you look at the same sort of theory but add more matter fields, so that instead of having a discrete chiral symmetry, you have continuous chiral symmetry, then you can have Goldstone bosons. And as Gorsky and Schiffman showed, if you count the number of Goldstone bosons in the parent and the daughter, they don't agree. But the orbifold equivalence never said that everything in the parent agrees with everything in the daughter. It was a specific statement about the sector that I termed neutral in the parent and the neutral sector in the daughter. So there are some questions that are good to compare and some questions about which you can say nothing. Sure enough, you can check the number of neutral Goldstone bosons in the parent agrees with the number of neutral Goldstone bosons in the daughter. So the disagreement of total number of Goldstone bosons was not a sign of any problem with this large N equivalence. For those of you who remember the story of Iguchi-Kawai reduction in gauge theory, this is just kind of fun. If you think about pure Yang-Mills theory on lattices, if you think about it formulated on, say, a big periodic lattice, in the large N limit, Iguchi and Kawai argued that there was no dependence on the size of the lattice. The theory in infinite volume should be the same as a theory compactified on a torus of any size, even a torus all the way down to just one site. And this, in fact, is a perfectly fine example of an orbifold projection, and everything I said applies to it. And there is a perfectly fine large N equivalence, provided those symmetry realization conditions are satisfied. Well, lo and behold, they're satisfied as long as the size of the lattice is larger than some critical size, but not below it. And Herbert Neuberger has fairly recently shown that that critical size really scales, or appears to scale in a continuum limit. So there's really a physical length below which the discrete symmetries in the daughter theory break spontaneously. Also, you can amusingly go the other way. You can start with a theory on a one-site lattice, regard that as the parent, do an orbifold projection, and create the theory on a lattice as big as you want. In other words, going from the matrix model to Yang-Mills theory on an arbitrarily big lattice is another example of an orbifold projection. I'm out of time. I know Misha's going to talk about orientifolds momentarily. I'll just flash this and say orientifold equivalence is yet another example of orbifold projection equivalence. but in the form of an equivalence not between a parent and a daughter, but two different daughters with a common parent. So if you've heard any rumors that say orbifolds are bad and orientifolds are good, that's an unfounded rumor. Orientifolds are an example of orbifolds, and they can be good. All right, I'll close by just flashing up here my conclusions, which speak for themselves. The non-perturbative orbifold equivalence is valid given these necessary symmetry realizations. What I find interesting is this is an example where you can actually say you have derived an exact duality under the assumption of that symmetry realization, not simply conjectured it and tested it. So at least one little corner of what we've learned about dualities between theories is more than conjecture. All right, I'll stop there. Thanks.
I want to make two comments. First of all, we never said that in general orbifold doesn't produce something which can be non-perturbative equivalent. But this particular example which you're given, I totally disagree with you, and I think it's very easy to make clear why I disagree with you. The example, and I will make two arguments. The example which you considered with Z2 orbifold. You agree with me, it's not a matter of defining or redefining theta. You agreed, in fact, you showed in one of your transparencies that the number of vacua in these two theories is different. In the parent theory it's 2n, in the daughter theory is n. Now in perturbation theory, even when you consider a correlation function in a given vacuum, you have no information whatsoever about the existence of other vacua. Okay, so that's the reason why perturbatively, under appropriate rescaling of the coupling constant, you get one and the same planar graphs. However, in the full non-perturbative theory, you don't have to believe me, we can check it right now, that if the number of vacua, total number of vacua in the daughter and the parent theory is different, it will show up in some correlation functions. Absolutely. Okay? And this example with the topological susceptibility, it's only one example. You can consider, for instance, take domain walls in these theories, okay? Domain walls in these theories, just the number of domains, distinct domain walls in these theories will be different, okay? So, and you cannot say that, okay, I mean, this is something which doesn't belong. It does belong because it is in the same common sector, okay? So another reason, I think a clear argument why there can be no equivalence. If you take anything but Z2, any other factor group, Z3 or Z2 cross Z2, your parent theory is non-chiral, vector-like, your daughter theory is necessarily chiral. And again, there can be given many arguments that non-perturbatively they are of course the same, because perturbation theory doesn't know about such subtleties as long as to any finite order in the Feynman graphs, planar Feynman graphs are the same, but non-planar theory cannot be non-perturbatively, I'm sorry, non-chiral theory cannot be non-perturbatively equivalent to the chiral theory. Okay, and basically the reason is the same, that one of the reasons is the same, that you cannot match the totality of vacua in one theory matched to the totality of vacua in the another.
Let me respond to those two points. So in reverse order. So for things like Z3 projections, let me simply say there is only one mechanism where this equivalence can fail, and that's if in either the parent or the daughter the appropriate discrete symmetries turn out to be spontaneously broken. Whether that happens, say, in an example of a Z3 projection or not, I'm not sure. I haven't really looked at that in detail. For the Z2 case, what you said turns out not to be the case.
What I said turns out not to be the case.
Well, hang on. So the statement of the equivalence is relating specific expectation values of a certain class of decent operators in the parent with that class of operators, or likewise for the correlators. Counting vacua is not...
Doing measurements with this class of operators, you will never feel non-perturbatively that the number of vacua is given. That's what you're saying.
If you look at the correlators, their leading behavior in large N exactly is this equivalence defined. That's precisely what I'm saying. Now, remember, of course, that talking about the number of vacua is clearly slippery. We're asking about the large N limit, and the number of vacua in the parent theory is going to infinity, right? You have 2N spontaneously broken vacua, so in a sense, all those vacua are becoming just, you know, a complete circle of vacua. So for finite n, that's correct.
For even for infinite net, because this is an anomalous U1 symmetry, and there is no Galstone boson corresponding to that. So they don't tend, in a sense, they never tend to U1, which you try to imply. And the fact that the number of vacua is different by this factor group, it will show up in appropriately chosen correlators which do obey your symmetry, because you cannot avoid. You see, the number of vacua. If you wish, let me couple the theory to very weak gravity or something. The number of vacua is as physical parameter of the theory as, say, the mass of the scalar glue ball. Okay, and it definitely can be measured. Can be measured by not by more than one way. And if the theory, one theory has 2n vacua and another theory has n vacua, they cannot be perturbatively, non-perturbatively equivalent, whatever you say. Maybe it's one of your criteria, maybe the other fails, but they cannot be equivalent.
This
okay?
is not a counterexample to the precise formulation of this large N duality, which is what I showed you, which is a specific mapping between correlators.
What you are claiming is that the number of vacua in a theory is not observable quantity. That's what you are saying.
Yes, that's what I'm
saying.
Okay,
if you are ready to say that, I have nothing to add.
Okay, any other questions?
Much easier question. On last transparency, you mentioned the scaling, which was found by Neuberger, yes? Mm-hmm. Do you think it would also persist in the space-only reduced theories? When you reduce them to quantum mechanical systems, you would expect also such relations, and then would there be a physical size of the box beyond which it will not happen?
Yes. Beyond which the large N, the properties of the large N theory will know about the size of the box that it's living in. Yes.
Sorry, I missed something. Did you show us that it was a sufficient condition, or you the unbroken the symmetries matching?
I showed you. Well, I mean, I didn't show you all the details, but I told you that you can show that the neutral subgroup of the coherence group of the parent is isomorphic to that of the daughter.
Yeah, but you need more, right? You wanted the matching of the Hamiltonians.
Okay, so I then have to show you that within the neutral sector,
right. The
two Hamiltonians agree. I didn't show you the details of that, so let me just say in words what's involved. So the challenge is, of course, to show that two functions are the same when you can't actually write down any clean, simple form for those functions. In the lattice regularized theory, I never really told you what state I started with to generate my coherent states. Nice feature is in the lattice regularized theory, you can pick a gauge invariant initial state that's easy to deal with. It's the state in which the gauge coupling constant is essentially infinite. So I can just show you a particular one of my coherent states where you can compute everything there is. I mean, it has no interesting physics at all. It's just one point in phase space where you can show that the expectation values of all observables coincide. Given that starting point, then the question is, Can you show that as you move away from that point in phase space, that the, you know, change, the variation in any observables are the same? Well, there's this nice structure. So you know what you mean by geodesics. It's easy to write down differential equations, which amount to geodesic equations saying how do expectation values change as you move in this phase space. And to work out the form of those equations, again, all it comes back to is knowing how to evaluate commutators in the parent and daughter theories. And so the more precise statement is you can show that those geodesic equations, which give you a set, a closed set of first order equations for expectation values of any Wilson loop or related observables, how they vary as you move around in the classical phase space, you show that those two sets of geodesic equations are simply the same. So then it's just the basic proof of all differential equations, right? Same equations, same initial condition, means they're the same everywhere.
But then you're on the strong coupling lattice side and you're approaching a phase transition to get the continuum limit. And is that right? Or?
I haven't said a word about what in any particular example on this lattice regularized theory, what its true phase structure may look like. I don't have to. All I have to say is, however you could choose to take a limit of that lattice theory in the parent to define a non-trivial continuum limit, if you do the same thing in the daughter, you'll also have a non-trivial continuum limit. And if you have this exact large N duality before you've taken the continuum limit, you'll have it after you've taken the continuum limit.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.